Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Marnie Svedberg, and I welcome you to Marnie and Friends, a place where leaders share practical, helpful, and encouraging ways to get anything important done faster, better, and smarter. Right now, I encourage you to sit back, buckle up, and join us for fun, laughter, practical help, and clear thinking, the kind of discussion that focuses our attention off of the fluff and onto the most important stuff in life. Again, welcome to Marnie's Friends. Let's get going.
Hi, this is Marnie Svedberg. Welcome back to another edition of Marnie's Friends, and I'm so excited to have one of my friends on the line with us today, Deborah Cody. Got to know Deborah a couple of years ago when she was part of our Bible Study Expo because she is the author of like 10 books, and they're all fun and awesome and deep and really helpful in the everyday life. She's a speaker. She is a writer, prolific writer. She not only writes books, but she's a contributor to numerous devotionals for women, as well as writes a monthly newsletter column or newspaper column. She's an orthopedic occupational therapist and a pianist, and she loves tennis, and she's here to share with us today on the topic of fear, faith, and a fistful of chocolate. Welcome to you, Deborah.
Thanks, Marnie. It's a delight to be here.
Well, it is great to have you, and I just have to tell you that this topic of fear versus faith is one that's really near and dear to my heart. In fact, I feel like God has me working on that one almost every day.
Oh, I hear you. I know a lot of women feel that way, and that was what pretty much led me to write this particular book.
Yeah, and you said that before you wrote it, you actually interviewed 500 women. And
yes, I did. I did. Back a few years ago, my first women's issue book was called Mom Needs Chocolate. And when I was, after I wrote that, I was invited to travel around to speak to women's groups. And as I did, I kept encountering the same general themes of issues that women were struggling with. And those were, you know, in this, no particular order, but this is the order that I address them in, they were stress, and how to deal with anger issues and self-control and fear, everyday fears. And so I came back from that and went to my publisher and asked if it would be possible for us to do a series of the type of books I write, which is truth, gift-wrapped, and humor. And they said, sure. So the first book that came out to address those issues was Too Blessed to Be Stressed, and then the second was More Beauty, Less Beast. And then this one that just came out last month is Fear, Faith, and a Fistful of Chocolate. So when I got ready to write the fear book, I knew that I wanted to know more about what the specific fears that women deal with were. So I took the survey of 500 women between the ages of 18 and 80. They were random women that I got that were willing to share their gut fears with me, which was just very amazing that that many would do that. And I was able to tally up the results and find the top 10 fears that women struggle with on a daily basis so that I could address those as well as other fears in the book. Would you like me to share those with you?
Yeah, go ahead and just list those right off.
Well, the number one fear across the board in all age categories, and I had them divided into three age categories just to make it a little easier to see where women really were, but across the board, the number one fear was more than doubled that of the number two fear in all of the age categories, which shows you how significant this particular fear is. And I would ask your listeners to just pause a moment and think about what their top few fears are that they wrestle with on an everyday basis so they can see how theirs compare with the others. And the interesting thing is that I projected certain outcomes of these surveys, and I was wrong. I think I was probably considering my own personal fears and projecting them on what I thought everybody else's were. So some of these were a real surprise to me. But the number one fear across the board was loss of a loved one, including a spouse, a child, or a parent. And then the number two fear was debilitating disease or terminal illness. Number three is fear of failure. And that was the largest one in the younger age range, which would be from 18 to 29. And that would make sense because, you know, those women are starting out in life and their marriages and their jobs. And, of course, they're trying not to fail in either and worrying about producing little serial killers instead of kids, you know. And so that would make sense that that was the top one for that age category.
What's
and
funny
then,
about that to me, Deborah, is that by the time you're 35 or whatever, you realize that you kind of are a failure, and so you're just okay with it after that.
Unfortunately, I know exactly what you're saying there. And so the number 4 and number 5 fears were actually a tie. And the number 4 was old age or senility, and that was, of course, predominant in the older age category. It seems like when we cross that mid-century point in age, we were facing our mortality and all of the things that go along with aging a little more clearly. And then number 5 is one that I personally struggle with the most. It's fear of the unknown or the what ifs. And then number 6 was loneliness. Number 7 was dependency on others. Number 8 was rejection. Number 9, specific critters like snakes and roaches and rats and all those things we combined into that nasty category. And then number 10 was being judged unfairly. And I tried to address all of these, and there were quite a few other fears that were written in that were not didn't quite make the top 10, like fear of flying, fear of depression, disappointing others, trying new things, fear of purposelessness. But those were not the ones that ranked highly enough to make the top 10.
It's interesting, Deborah, because when I had your list of 10 in front of me when I asked you to list them off for everybody, and as I had reviewed that list, I actually had the same one as you, the fear of the unknown or the what ifs. And I wouldn't even say that that is my number one fear worded like that. I would say that I have frequent faith crises where I believe God is going to do something, but then I'm not quite sure that he is, you know, like that. How do you describe your unknown and what ifs? How do you describe that fear for you when that's your number one?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with my family, and it's probably tied into that number one fear, loss of a loved one. And a lot of it revolves around my children. I think a lot of women have that problem. I hear that repeated. But I'll lay awake at night, and I will think, oh, you know what? What if such and such were to happen? And then if that happened, this other thing would probably happen. And then, oh, my goodness, if that happened, what would I ever do if this happened? And it just goes on and on. And you drive yourself crazy with these faceless what ifs. They're the faceless fears. And that's one of the points I try to make in the book is we have to try to give our fears a face. Because we can deal with something we can see a lot better than we can deal with something we can't see.
So talk to us about that a little bit. How would you give your fears a face?
Well, I have 5 categories that I place our fears in, and I do that just for the purpose of identifying our fears. And that's one of the things these faceless fears do. I call them our fear monsters, and they're hiding just on the periphery of our vision where we can't see them. And many times we don't really know what those fears really are. We're not aware of some of the things that maybe happened to us in our past, even in our childhoods, that have developed these fears that govern our behavior as adults, but we're not even aware of them. So one of the things that I recommend that we do in addressing our fears is, first of all, identify them. Give them a face. Try to figure out what the name of that fear. What is it? What does it look like? And in order to do that, I've developed 5 categories that are very simple, that all start with the letter S, just to make it easier to try to remember. And those would be spurting fear, and a type of a spurting fear would be the naked emotion, an unpremeditated gut-level reaction to something that's elicited. For instance, if you had it's usually based on a previous experience. So it would be like, for instance, if you saw your neighbor's dog out walking around in his fence yard, and all of a sudden you just went into heart palpitations, and, you know, you were just having your sweats and your fear just controlling you. All of a sudden you didn't know why. That would be an example of a spurting fear, that raw, impulsive reaction. And then a savory fear would be like the delicious thrill kind of thing that we actually enjoy, that it's a specific controlled thing or event that involves no real danger or damage. It's fear within our safety zones. An example of that would be riding a roller coaster or driving fast or maybe entering a house of horrors. And then there's the saturating fear. And that's the invasive type of fear that often originates in childhood, and it permeates our lives in ways we don't always see. That would be the kind of fear that becomes a phobia as an adult. It's the type of thing that's enmeshed within our personalities. And that would be, I have several examples of that in my book, but an example would be a fear of abandonment that pervades your adult relationships because your father left when you were small. Or a simmering fear. That's the fear of the unknown. That's the things that we've never really experienced, but we've developed an underlying dread for based on other people's experience and our own speculation. An example of a simmering fear would be the what ifs, or worrying about financial ruin or death. And then the sovereign fear is the fifth type of fear, the fifth category. Sovereign fear is born of respect. It's not really the sphincter pucker moment kind of fear that we're used to thinking of when we say the word fear, but it's the subjection that we willingly place ourselves under to authorities, such as our parents, our teachers, or even Papa God.
Beautiful. Beautiful. I love how you've, we've all experienced all of these kind of fears, and it does help us to categorize them a little bit better. Now, in your book, one of the things I noticed, and I really love how you do this, is that at the beginning of each chapter, you have kind of a catchy title, and then underneath it, you say, you know, what this chapter is about. So, like, chapter 3 is, like, rejection. And the name of the book is, again, Fear, Faith, and a Fistful of Chocolate. And we're talking about fear versus faith here and how we deal with it, and rejection is the third chapter. And you go through this chapter, and you kind of identify, you give us specific things, and then at the end, you have questions that make us think. So I'm going to ask a question here out of this chapter, and I want you to just maybe give a couple examples for rejection of what you shared in the chapter, as well as what might be someone's answer to this question after reading it, because it will give people a taste for how you approach this topic. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. So the question I'm going to ask you is, do you tend to overinflate worry balloons into dirigibles? How can you keep the Hindenburg from floating around inside your head at night? Okay, so that kind of gives you an example of how she talks in the book, guys. But so talk to us about the worry balloons and the Hindenburgs.
Well, I know that I'm like the queen at making those worry balloons expand, you know, and I've learned over the years that worry is a learned behavior. And if it's a learned behavior, it can be unlearned if we have the right tools and the motivation to do that. And I have a lot of different instances in my book. I went on a fret fast that I talk about for 2 weeks, and I realized how that, to use particular tools to turn my worry into prayer and to make something useful out of all that fretting and to actually have it productive, made such a difference and freed up my spirit in ways I never knew was possible. But that's in another chapter, so I'll come back to this particular chapter that you're talking about. And the questions are called More Pluck, Less Chicken, that I have in the back. And those are predominantly for people who are trying to dig a little deeper themselves into how to conquer their fears, and for Bible study groups. I had quite a few Bible studies contact me that used my other books, Too Blessed to Be Stressed and More Beauty, Less Beast, and asked for an expanded version of the reflection questions. So that's what these are that we're talking about today. So about those worry balloons, this particular chapter talks about a friend of mine named Philip, and Philip is a perfectionist, and I love him dearly, but we are totally opposite ends of the spectrum. He absolutely would not let anyone eat or drink anything in his car, and if you know me, I'm like, oh my gosh, Miss Sloppy, you know, I always have my chocolate, of course, stuffed into my purse, plus my granola bars with little crumbs everywhere. So when my husband and I would travel with Philip and his wife, you know, I would always sneak a little something out of the back of my purse in the back and nibble on it. And one time I got in Philip's car, and he had the entire back seat draped with towels just to make his point. And, you know, so I knew Philip was a perfectionist and that sometimes it was very, very difficult for him because he actually had a deep-seated fear of rejection that had started when he was a little thing. His dad left his family when he was 2, and Philip never saw his dad again until the first time he saw his dad again was when he was about 10, and it was at a family funeral, and Philip had not seen his dad, but he had seen pictures, so he knew what he looked like. And when he saw this man that he knew to be his dad approaching the funeral home doors, Philip was like, oh, really excited to see him. And his dad, as he walked through the door and saw Philip standing there, turned his back and left.
Hmm.
And if you just can't feel any more rejection than that, if you can imagine. And then years passed, and Philip did see his dad again briefly. But the point of that was that, you know, I asked Philip, who was a very strong Christian, what did he do? How did he deal with that type of rejection? And Philip had some really wonderful things to say, and I used those along with some other things that I got from other people who have had some horrible rejections in their life to try to give us some tips and some tools for dealing with that rejection monster. And a couple of them were, number one, deal with the anger. Acknowledge that there's anger there, even if it's buried deep beneath those layers of denial. When you have rejection, you're going to have anger, whether or not you think it's not Christian to be indignant, or maybe you've just become very proficient at stuffing it, but there's anger there, and it's time to deal with that nasty thing so you're no longer feeling afraid of being vulnerable and exposed. And then another thing is to accept yourself, to recognize that you're not defined by what you do, but by whom Papa God ultimately designed you to be, and you are a work in progress. And I want to try to make it clear, and Philip said it very well, that our actions don't dictate who we are and whether or not we're acceptable to Papa God. Philip said this, and I'll quote him, "Your self-esteem is not derived from your performance or how nice your car, your house, or even your body looks. Your self-worth comes from the one who created you, and he's already shown you what he thinks of you by sending his beloved son to die in your place." And then another thing, one of the other points, is to work on your self-esteem. You know, people with very little confidence often struggle with fear of rejection because they kind of think to themselves, oh, I am so pathetic. I don't blame anyone for disrespecting me. We don't even respect ourselves. But, you know, I spend a little time talking about how we can actually develop our self-esteem and realize that we are wanted, that we're cherished, that we're loved without limits. And that is so important to know that our Papa God knows us intimately and he adores us. A good scripture passage to emphasize that point would be Psalm 139:15 and 17 and 18. I just love that passage. We just are assured that Papa God will never leave us or forsake us, and he is absolutely dedicated to us. And then one other, and there's several others than this, but I know for the sake of time I won't keep rambling on, but one other tool under that particular chapter is to listen to the right voice. We all have those little voices speaking over our shoulders, the wise voice and the stupid voice. The wise voice, do you have those now? The wise voice says it's okay to like yourself. After all, Papa God's proud of you. You're one of his very favorites. But then the stupid voice counters with, you're a worthless loser. Who could possibly like you? And the stupid voice and the wise voice continue to battle it out for which is going to be loudest and which one we're going to listen to. And so we have to choose which voice we're going to listen to.
I almost think, you know, stupid voice is a, you know, kind of a fun way to say it, but I almost think that there is just evil in that voice, that there is destruction in that voice. And that's one of the things that I work with a lot with myself, just to catch those really destructive thoughts that are playing. And they just come almost from nowhere. They maybe come from past. Some of them definitely were planted there when I was little or, you know, whatever. But they just bubble to the surface at the most inopportune times and unexpected times, kind of almost like in the same way that there are five categories of fear. I bet there are five different categories of ways that these thoughts come at us. But when these stupid thoughts or really ungodly thoughts come at us, I have a practice that I do with those thoughts. What is your own response when you recognize, Deborah, a thought in your head that just can't be from God? You just know, okay, wait. God wouldn't say that to me, so why am I saying that to me? What do you do with that thought?
Well, I would love to hear how you deal with that. I really would. For me personally, I have to back off. I use a system I call BARF. I'm simple but not stupid, but I do have to have simplicity for me to be able to have things at my fingertips in order to react. But it's called BARF, B-A-R-F, back off. Well, now all of a sudden I can't remember what BARF stands for. Wait a second.
You know, that's
I'll get
okay.
It.
I'll share mine, and then we'll come back to that because
okay,
I do want to hear
ahead.
That acronym. So let me give you a second to think that out. And what I see is that, you know, I was looking at my little cell phone, and it's like this with cameras now too. Each of them has this little memory chip in it, right? And if you take that memory chip out, all of the content on that particular chip goes out with it, right? So I was thinking that's kind of how these thoughts are for me. They're like part of me. Somehow they became part of me. And so when I have a thought that comes to my, it comes in my brain, okay, but I view that my heart, the center of me, is not the same as my brain. My brain is separate from my heart or the core of me, the place where the Holy Spirit dwells, that spiritual part of me that is sending out the signals from God to my brain, and it's coming through, you know, me, which isn't very clear. You know, I've still got sin issues, so sometimes it's a little polluted. What God says to me doesn't always get to my brain clear. It sometimes gets messed up a little bit because of my thinking. But inside the very core of me is the Holy Spirit of God. And that's the true of you, Deborah, and true of anybody who's listening who's received Christ as their Savior, then the Holy Spirit comes to live in us. Well, this Holy Spirit is speaking truth to my mind. And then when there's a thought in my mind that I know for sure can't be from him. So, for instance, I may feel guilt and condemnation. Well, I know based on Romans 8:1 that that would not be from God. Now, conviction might be from God, but conviction is when I say, I'm sorry, I was wrong, please forgive me, I don't want to do that again. There is no more sad feeling there. All of a sudden, you know, I may have the consequences of it still, but I feel no more guilt and conviction. So if I have residual guilt and conviction, I know that can't be from God. So when I have these feelings, then I just do this little thing. I just take my, either mentally or physically, if I can do it physically, I do it physically because it's such a beautiful picture to me, and it helps me so much to really believe that I can be free of these things through Christ. So I just take my fingers and I just take into my center of my core of my body, like right under my heart or above my tummy, right in that center core place, and I just pinch a little bit, and I don't pinch really hard, but hard enough to notice that I'm doing it. I just pinch it and I like remove the memory chip of that bad thing.
Oh, I love that.
And then I squish it between my fingers as if to make it dust. And then I open my hand and I say, God, now talk to me about that from your perspective. What's truth? And in that moment, I know that that particular seed thought that's been in me is now gone. And what I know, Deborah, is that sometimes it takes a lot of times to do that before we get the entire thing out of us. We've been feeding it for a long time before we even noticed it. So that's kind of what I do. But now, if you are ready, tell us the rest of the BARF acronym, because we aren't going to forget this quickly. BARF.
No, but you know what? It's very tied in with what you just said, and I just love what you said. And I, too, agree 100% that to do a gesture, to perform some kind of physical action as a symbolic way to get rid of those ugly thoughts, to get rid of anger, if you will. That's what we need to do, and I do the same thing. And I'll tell you about that as I tell you about BARF. But the B in BARF stands for back off. And this is mostly when I get angry or very critical or some kind of condemnation thing going in my head that I'm very, usually anger is the root of the problem. So my little catchphrase is I'm angry enough to BARF. I need to do it.
Okay.
And so to back off is the first step, to actually turn your back on the problem, gain a new perspective, take a deep breath, ask Papa God for help. And then A is to admit, to identify what you're feeling, what your emotions are, because that's how we have to deal with them. It's the same kind of principle as putting a face on our fear.
Right.
We have to know what it is before we can know what to do about it. And so I admit to myself, I am feeling jealous. I'm feeling used, I'm feeling unappreciated, whatever it is, and that's what I need to do. And then R is to redirect, to refocus my emotions into a healthier direction. And in order to do that, I do my little gesture of it's symbolic to me that Papa God is in control and that Satan is the one who is trying his darndest to put these thoughts in my head. And so to remind myself that he is already in the coffin, I tap my fists on top of each other quietly, 1, 2, 3 taps. And that reminds me that those nails are banged into that coffin. He is in there. Satan has already been defeated, and that Jesus has already won the victory for me. And I just have to realize it and claim it. And then I can redirect my emotions into a healthier direction because I've just been able to diffuse all those bad feelings and that anger. And then F is probably the hardest part of barf. It's to forgive. To forgive first my offender and then forgive myself. Hmm. And that's probably the hardest part. But that's what I do. I barf.
You barf. Well, you know, the reality is, Deborah, we're either going to barf in a good way or we barf in a bad way. I mean, that's just it. Because in those moments, and I call it, you know, either you're going to spew it out or you're going to stuff it down. That's one of the choices. Mm-hmm. But either which way, you have a victim. You either have the victim of the person who's going to receive your anger or your frustration in the moment outside, external of you, or you have yourself as victim, where you stuff it down and it becomes a boiling cauldron and it eats you from the inside out. So either which way, if you don't take care of this with Jesus, you're going to hurt somebody, either yourself or somebody else.
That is so true.
It's just so beautiful that God gives us this way where we can actually have the emotion occur in us and not sin and not hurt anybody. And
it's a mystery, especially to people who are not believers and don't understand the supernatural access of power that we have.
Right.
Because it's something that doesn't make sense if you're trying to explain it to somebody. It's like joy in the midst of horrible circumstances.
Right.
When we have that Jesus joy, it's a mystery. And it's very impossible to explain unless you've experienced it yourself.
Yeah, so cool. Well, I love that, and thank you. That was awesome. I'm going to take you to another chapter, and we're going to do it again, and then we'll move on a little bit. But chapter 9 is called Hung Up, and it's about controlling obsessions, which I think, you know, we could call those addictions or obsessions or things that just, it's like been in your life as long as you can remember or for way too long, and you're sick of it, you want to get out from under it, but it just seems to keep on being a problem for you over and over and over. And I'm going to ask you the fifth question out of More Pluck, Less Chicken, which is, so what does your Ebenezer look like? What does your monument acknowledging Papa God's help in controlling your fear or this obsession look like? So talk to us about the obsessions and some of what you teach about this, how to get out from under the fear of the obsession, because really, the fear of the obsession is usually what's holding it in place, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, do you agree with that? Maybe you don't agree with that.
No, I do agree with that. I think that's very true. Well, to answer your question, first of all, what is an Ebenezer? And I think we need to probably make that clear. That's a term used in a wonderful old hymn that a lot of people hear, I raise my Ebenezer. And they've heard it, but they don't really know what it means. And I just love that term. It comes from 1 Samuel 7, 9 through 13. And it's a story of Israel when Samuel was helping to lead the Israelites, and they were in war. And the Philistines were stronger and bigger, and there was no way the Israelites should have won. But Samuel prayed, and because he prayed, the Lord made all this crazy thunder crash all around, confused the Philistines, and they ran away and were horribly beaten. And so after the battle, Samuel set up a monument. He called it his help monument, which translates Ebenezer. And that's what it was, to remind him how much the Lord had helped him. And the last line of that passage says, for as long as Samuel lived, the Lord helped Israel fight the Philistines. Mm-hmm. And whenever Samuel doubted, he could go back to that help monument or that Ebenezer, and he would remember and know what the Lord had done for him. And it translated into our terms today, he was able to default to faith rather than fear whenever he was facing another battle and something that was possibly something that could kill him. And then in that chapter, you mentioned I discuss a friend of mine. I just love this gal. Her name's Eddie, and she lives in my neighborhood as a dear friend. And Eddie is the epitome of a fearful person. Or I should say Eddie was the epitome of a fearful person. She was raised in Newark, New Jersey, and way back. She's she's probably a smidge older than me, so I'd say she's in her late 50s now. But she was raised back when it was a very dangerous place to live, a lot of racial tension everywhere, very, very crime-ridden, and she was one of the fifth of seven children, and she had very little supervision from her parents because they were always working, and so she was tormented, basically, by her brothers and sisters, for the most part, as well as the community there, which was just scary to live in anyway. But she has numerous fears as an adult that came from her fears that were embedded in her as a child, and they've become obsessions as an adult. One of those is that she's terrified of butterflies, of all things, because one of her older brothers would chase her around with a butterfly and threaten her and say, if I touch you with this, you're going to turn into a caterpillar.
Wow.
And so Eddie believed him. And, you know, of course, that seems illogical to us now, but fear is not logical.
Right.
And so then she had this other doll. She had this doll named Numa, she called her. She was. I don't know if you are old enough to remember this, Marnie, but back in the day, they made those big, giant, life-size dolls that we all wanted. And they would, if you held her hand and put their feet just right, you could act like they were walking with you. You know, they were just awesome. So anyway, she had a doll like that named Numa. And one of her brothers would sneak Numa all over the house and have it suddenly appear in doorways and closets, as if Numa had walked there on her own. And it would terrify Eddie. She was afraid Numa had come to life. And part of that problem was that she had seen an Alfred Hitchcock show on TV about a doll that came to life. And so she just knew that Numa was going to, you know, terrify her the rest of her life. And it's funny because Eddie, as an adult, she still has Numa. And, in fact, Numa is one of her Ebenezers, sitting in the front of her house. If you go up to her house, right in the front window, you see Numa standing there. And she dresses her for each occasion, for each holiday. She has an Easter dress for her and a hat, and she puts her in Christmas clothes. And, you know, she said people have often asked her about this doll. And Eddie said, well, I kept her all these years because, you know, the old saying, you know, keep your friends close but your enemies closer. And she was always afraid if she tried to get rid of her, Numa would come back. So she was terrified of that, and because they were in the inner city, they had a lot of vermin. They had a lot of rats in their building. And so because of that, Eddie would hear at night the snap of the rat traps, and she could hear them squealing and all this stuff, which just made her then be terrified of anything creeping and crawling on the floor, to the point where she would never, for the rest of her life, have any kind of bedspread that had tassels on it, because she was always afraid something would crawl up those tassels and get up in the bed with her at night. And so there were just numerous things. Her mother would caution, because their parents weren't around to supervise the kids, they would tell them, if you go anywhere near water, standing water, you're going to drown. And so Eddie never learned to swim, nor did any of her siblings. They stayed away from water because they just knew they were going to drown. Well, her mom was doing that for their own, you know, protection, but it became a real phobia for Eddie. Well, then as Eddie got to be a preteen, our family finally relocated to some suburbs that were much quieter and not so inner city. That was the year that Martin Luther King was shot, and their front window was shattered by a bullet. So they moved. And then all her rest of her life, Eddie was able to finally go to school, and she married a wonderful man, and she ended up having two sons and had a wonderful job. She finished college, but those fears just kept invading her life. And then fast forward about three decades from the time she was raised in Newark, she ended up moving to my neighborhood, and she was terrified of everything. Her husband came before her and purchased the house. Actually, they rented a house at first before they purchased one. But he rented this house before she came down with a pool. And I don't know if you've ever been to Florida, Marnie, but we have lots of creepy crawly critters around here, especially the lizards. And we have thousands of lizards. And being a born and raised Floridian, they do not bother me. I mean, I don't mind the lizards. They bite sometimes, but they don't have teeth, so they don't hurt. And, you know, I tried to impress Eddie to show her how harmless they were, and I clamped a couple on my earlobes to show her you could wear them as earrings. She did not appreciate
not
that.
Not impressed. Funny.
So Eddie ended up being a prisoner in her own home. Mm-hmm. When there were butterflies all over her yard, and she was just terrified of everything, and she would not leave her home. She shut all the doors and windows, closed the sliding glass door to the lanai where the pool was, pulled the bar for 4 weeks in the dark, afraid to venture out at all. She knew that some of those creepy crawly lizards were going to chase her into the pool, and then she was going to drown, and there nobody would ever know about it until her husband came home at the end of the day. So, you know, she just had all these fears, and then she began coming to our neighborhood Bible study, which was certainly a God thing.
Yeah.
And she was shy at first, so she didn't tell us much about herself. But another gal in there was talking about Joyce Meyer's CD set, The Spirit of Fear. And so Eddie began, you know, paying attention and asked if she could borrow it. And she felt so much encouraged by the things Joyce Meyer said. And she began to realize she wasn't the only person who was dealing with a lot of these fears. And then I won't go into further detail, but the rest of the chapter in the book talks about the different things Eddie tried and failed and then tried and succeeded with God's help to do to conquer those fears. And I'm so happy to say at this point she has bought a house in the neighborhood, a different house, and it has a pool, and she did it intentionally. And she has these Ebenezers up in her yard to remind her that God can conquer her fears, and to her help monuments to show her that God helped her when she needed. She has this big butterfly on a stick out there. It's beautiful. It's a metal lawn ornament. And she also has a lizard in the back. It's so funny to go back there and see this big lizard on the stick. It reminds me of the snake in the wilderness on the pole.
Yeah, right, right. Yep.
But, you know, and she calls them her Ebenezers. And we even renamed Numa, her doll, Numanizer.
Numanizer.
You know.
Cute.
And these are the ways that she did it. And I spoke with her about a lot of little tools that she could share with other people. And I also did some more research. And I have some tools listed in that chapter as well for different ways that you can, first of all, recognize your fear, directly address it, and then become assertive about educating yourself and not fertilizing that fear. I call that boo-poo. That's the manure that feeds the seeds of fear and sprouts stinking thinking. But different ways you can mute the power of suggestion of your fears. And then to practice being unafraid. And I think there's some things in there could help people that seem to have obsessions that they just don't know what to do about.
That's awesome. Now, I want to, you know, I loved that you used Eddie as your example here, because even though she's maybe kind of an extreme example, because a lot of us don't have that degree of fear instilled in us as a child, but yet all of us have fears. And I'm sure that along the way there, we were able to, you know, kind of identify at least some little bit with Eddie's fears, and we have those. So the Ebenezer, let's talk about that for a minute, because I was trying to think in my own life, do I have an Ebenezer? And I really don't have a physical, visible Ebenezer. What I have for mine is I have a list, actually. I have a list where I sat down with God and I just said, you know, I want you to help me to see what are some of the things that you've done for me in the past. Help me remember some of the things you've done for me in the past that I can use when I'm in that kind of a situation and I need to remember. So he helped me to remember, you know, a time when I was financially in a situation that was very uncomfortable, and how he provided for me in that situation. So I have one for finances. He helped me remember a time when I was just letting him guide my life and letting him order my steps, and he did just a series of miracles, one right after another. And I use just three letters for that one to help me remember that situation, Ada. And there are other things that I wrote down like that, and I have like seven or eight. And I put them on a little card,
and I just carry them with me, because sometimes I'll be in a situation where I'll have a money crisis or a faith crisis, or maybe it's a relational crisis. Well, I can look, you know, you did this for me before, and I have it right with me. So that's kind of how I do it. What are some of your own personal Ebenezers, so people get a feel for what an Ebenezer can be for them and how they could actually make a help monument even yet today?
Well, my biggest Ebenezer is my house. And it was from, and I often think about this, because it was from a situation where we needed to move. We were in a crime-ridden neighborhood. Our kids were growing up, and our house was very, very tiny. And we were having lots of crime happen all around us. And I had been praying and praying for 2 years. We put up our house for sale, and the market at that time was very sluggish. And I emphasize very. And we have had it for 2 years for sale, and nothing. Not we had like three people even look at it. Mm-hmm. And we, I was resistant to go look at another house because I thought, well, what if I find one, you know, and I can't get it because I can't sell ours yet. So, in fact, I talk about this whole story in my book, Mommy's Chocolate. And I ended up turning it over to the Lord on my knees, and he reassured me that he was there. He was the God in control. And through this incredible series of miracles, we were able to obtain the house that we have today, even though the odds were completely against us and every obstacle in the world was in our path. But he somehow was the God of miracles for us. And my other Ebenezer is my sister's house. She lives right down the street from me. And she also had, hers was a life and death situation, which was just an incredible story that I haven't been able to tell yet because it's still so close to me. And but I'm working on that for my next book to get that story in there. It's one that'll drive you to your knees. It's just amazing. But God, again, came through. And so that is our Ebenezers. And, you know, the thing to me that it ties into that I try to emphasize in this book about fear and dealing with our fears is it's a way, when we raise Ebenezers, it's a way to work on ourselves to develop what I call miracle memory.
Mm-hmm.
It's a, I've been a therapist in physical therapy clinics for 35 years now. So I know a thing or two about muscle memory. And muscle memory, of course, is what athletes develop. They practice the same motions over and over and over. It's what enables a gymnast to land a back tuck on a 4-inch balance beam, and it enables a pitcher to put that pitch right over the inside corner. It's because they do it and do it and do it so many times that their muscles default to the motions that they've learned. They learn it. They know it. They know what to do. They don't have to think about it. And that's what I think we do when we raise an Ebenezer, and we continually develop that miracle memory where we don't have to think about how to react when we face something that's new or different or that is very scary to us. We can automatically default to those memories that God has done in our past and see our Ebenezers and know that He is God and He is in control. And then we have the miracle memory. Rather than defaulting to fear, we automatically default to faith and to trust.
I love that. That is so beautiful. And that's just such a true statement there. It is. That's why some people really struggle with something that, like, okay, so, Deborah, you're going to have a different list of struggles in your life than I do. Why is that? Because it's what we've been exposed to. It's what we've learned over time. I love how you said earlier in this program that worry is a learned behavior. That's so true. If you were raised by parents who never worried and you weren't around, you know, your grandparents didn't worry really and they just trusted God and they modeled that for you, you really have very little issue with worry in your life. Whereas if you were raised in a situation where the people around you were always worried about everything, worry is a huge factor for you. Why is that? Because it's got memory. Our minds have memory. And that's why I think we have to differentiate between what's going on in our brain compared to what's going on our spirit, and always let God be healing the brain one thought at a time with that, getting those memory chips out of there. You talk about the connection between fear and guilt. What is the connection? Is there a connection?
Well, yes, I think there is, and people perhaps don't realize that there is because they seem like they're such different things. But, in fact, I talk about this in several of my other books, too, but guilt is a byproduct of fear. I think it's the fear of inadequacy, of maybe not measuring up, of not being good enough, of letting someone down, and in some cases, it's even the fear of God's wrath because we messed up. And, you know, that guilt serves to make us feel worthless and unworthy of Papa God's love. You know, we think we're too bad or we're too useless or we're too far gone for any hope of restoration. And when that happens, guilt becomes our master. It's our primary motivator. And it builds this stubborn, impenetrable wall in our relationship with Papa God. And I have a chapter on guilt, which it starts with a hilarious story about a cat shish kebab, which all my friends who are cat lovers go, "What?" But it actually, it's not as gross as it sounds. It has a happy ending. But that's the story that I get the most comments on from any readers who read the book, is the cat shish kebab story. But it starts out with that one to emphasize how guilt affects us. And, you know, it's so true. And I think we have to address guilt because it is a byproduct of our fear, and it's a symptom that we have some fears going on that we may not be aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think guilt is just a huge one that Satan is always, it says in the Bible that he's constantly standing, accusing us. That's he loves to just throw accusations at us all the time. And the best position that I've learned is just to recognize that that's happening, just to be aware of it and say, of course, I'm going to have thoughts that fly by my head that tell me that I'm a loser, that I'm worthless, that and this is not coming necessarily from inside of me. Some of it maybe is, but some of it's coming from outside of me, being spoken to my brain by the invisible realm around us. And, of course, you know, the thing to do with those thoughts is always run them straight to Dad. And what you have just explained to us here is that when we embrace the guilt, when we actually own it, that builds a wall between us and God. So instead, it does exactly the opposite of what God would want it to do. I always say, you know, when I have a thought of worry or when I have a thought of, you know, self-abuse, a thought that would be something that would not be from God, there are two choices. I can either run into God or I can just try to deal with it myself. So one is actually good, and that's where, you know, we have Romans 8, 28 and 29. All things work together for good. And then the next verse says to conform us to the image of Christ. So no matter what thought you're having, it's not the problem. The thought is not the problem. It's an opportunity to run that to God and deepen your relationship with him. Or if you own the thought, if you actually accept it and start to pet it and start to invest in it and start to worship it, that's when it becomes the problem.
That's so true. And I differentiate between, and this is hard to differentiate between with my accent because they both sound the same, so I'll have to spell them. But I talk about it in Fear, Faith, and Fistful of Chocolate, but I've also talked about it in a little more detail in my previous book, More Beauty, Less Beast. But two types of guilt. The ice cream guilt, spelled I-C-E-C-R-E-A-M, and the ice cream guilt, spelled I-S-C-R-E-A-M. And the ice cream guilt is about behaviors that can and probably should be changed, like scarfing down a half gallon of Chunky Monkey before bed. But those are that's the type of guilt that it's a fact of life for believers because we will not only expect it, we'll welcome it because it's our alarm sounding that we violated God's value system. And basically it's something that we're going to deal with and we should deal with. And that's things that can be changed with the ice cream guilt. But then there's the ice cream guilt, which is the endless obsession about things that are out of our control to change. Mm-hmm. It's that nagging, debilitating, unhealthy guilt that dogs us until we want to scream. And it's things that we cannot change, things that we can't do anything about. And I use an example about my friend Esther, and I talk about her several different times in the book for different reasons. But she's a mentor to me. She's a very strong Christian, born of pain. She lost her 2-year-old to cancer and many other things she's endured. But she's been just gold. She's come out of the end refined and beautiful and so helpful to the rest of us in refining our own faith. But she says this about that guilt, that I-S-C-R-E-A-M guilt, that we can't let go, that we just keep hanging on to. And she says, look at it like it's a maggot-infested carcass. It's a dead thing. Guilt is a dead thing, she says. And she says, if you think of it, of your old, already forgiven sin as a dead thing, imagine digging it up from its grave every time you revisit it. Ew. You know, who wants to play with a decaying dead thing? So it helps us if we can visualize that already forgiven sin that I scream guilt and recognize it, leave it buried, and move on.
The Bible talks about that God loves it when we offer up a sacrifice of praise, and that's what's coming to my mind, that picture of that. You know, you want to scream, you want to you want to obsess again about this thing that you used to obsess about, and it's coming to your mind again, and that in that moment, that's what I have, the choice in my mind. I have this choice. I can either think about this thing, this guilt, this thing that's done and taken care of in my past, or I can be in this present moment praising God for bringing me to this present moment. And that's where I call the sacrifice of praise, is when everything about my emotions wants to invest in the old thought process, and everything about my spirit wants to be with Jesus in gratitude.
Oh, that's so good.
I just love that we have that choice. We have that choice. Embrace it. Okay, so talk to us about vultures. What do the vultures do? What are the vultures in our life, and what do they do, and how do we make sure that they stop doing that?
Well, I actually came to the analogy of the vultures, and I have a whole chapter about vultures, and I'll tell you what they are in just a sec, but I like to do prayer walks around my neighborhood, and one day I was walking down around the lake, and I noticed that one of my neighbors has a vulture infestation. He has these giant vultures lined up on the top of his roof.
Wow.
And I started thinking about that. You know, vultures are raptorial birds that exist on dead things. They eat carcasses, you know, and they're not going to hang around unless there's something there for them to eat. And so I started thinking about that, and the Lord kind of put the thought in my mind that, you know, vultures, I think we have vultures too as Christians. They're those spiritual predators or those fears that loiter about overhead stalking us. And, you know, these are in my book I talk about the vultures of public disgrace or embarrassment or humiliation that are just hovering over our heads waiting to pick at the bones of our failures. And they only hang around because we keep them well fed with the worries that we won't fit in, or that we'll look foolish or stupid or ignorant or different, or that maybe we'll be laughed at or ridiculed. And all those vultures do is to remind me and the rest of the world that I blew it again. And then we can become so paralyzed by our fears of doing something wrong that we do nothing at all. And so as long as we keep those vultures well fed with the decomposing debris in our life, the failed relationships, the abandoned dreams, all of those incomplete projects or the good intentions that are gasping their last breaths, then they're going to hang around. And the way to get rid of the vultures occurred to me as I was crossing my neighbor's yard to try to snap a picture of the real vultures up there on his roof for my blog. And the first thing they did was to spread their gigantic wingspans and scream at me and try to scare me and try to intimidate me. And when that didn't work and I kept moving forward, they flapped around a while and complained, and then finally they flew away because I was a bigger life force than they were and I wasn't going anywhere. And so it occurred to me, well, that's how we get rid of our spiritual vultures, too. You know, we bring Papa God front and center in our lives because he is the biggest life force there is. And those spiritual vultures, they're intimidated by him. They are completely overwhelmed and outclassed, and they are out of here as long as he is the one that's front and center in our lives. So that's where the vulture analogy came from.
I love that. And I can just almost imagine that there are some listeners right now going, she walked right up to him. How did you have the courage?
They were up on the roof, actually. I was down on the ground, and they were up on the roof, so it wasn't quite as scary as all that.
But, you know, I mean, the reminder here is that God is bigger. God is always bigger. I like the story that, he wrote the book Piercing the Darkness, and I'm trying to think of that guy's name.
Frank Peretti
tells the illustration, and this has been just huge for me, but about the father riding in the car, and his little girl was in the back seat, and she was allergic to bee stings, and a bee got in the car and was buzzing around, and she started screaming with terror because she knew that that bee could not sting her or she would possibly die. And so the dad just reached, and he was able to grab that bee and hold it in its hand, and the bee stung him. And then he released the bee, and now the bee was flying around the car, and she's still screaming, and he's like, "But honey, it's okay. It's okay. He can't sting you. It's okay. He'll leave in a second, but it's okay. He can't sting you. I've got the stinger. He can't sting you. It's okay." But because of her great fear, her preconceived idea of what a bee would do to her, stinger or stingerless, she's kept on screaming. And that's how we behave. We've got this God who's taken the sting for us. And yet whenever we see, you know, a vulture, or whenever we see one of these fears that we're used to paying homage to, used to worshiping and used to investing our thoughts and our, you know, emotions into, we just get so suckered in, and we just keep screaming and screaming and screaming, and God's the whole time like, "Baby, it's okay.
Oh,
I took the stinger." You know, so for those of you who are listening, I just hope that you have heard encouragement today. Wow, Deborah, this was an amazing hour, and I'm so grateful that you could join us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Well, Deborah's the author of several books, and you can check them out over at her website, deborahcoty.com. That's deborahcoty.com. Lots of great stuff over there. And you'll also find that her books are wonderful for Bible studies. So if this has really triggered something inside of you and you're like, I know that I need more. She has whet my appetite now to really tackle my fears and trade them out for faith. And Deborah, I always say that fear is actually faith. It's just faith in godless. It's faith in a non-God approach to life. It's faith in something that God isn't part of. And God wants us to have our faith in Him. And so we have the opportunity with this book, Fear, Faith, and a Fistful of Chocolate, to move from putting our faith in fear to putting our faith in God, the God who's overcome all the fear. And one of the things you say, Deborah, is that the words "fear not" are in the Bible more than any other set of words, and that is so important for us to remember, that this is a huge issue. It's not just us. It's not just me. It's not just you. Everybody deals with this. This is so huge.
And so true.
I just encourage you guys to get this book for your group. Take your Bible study through this. You'll have a lot of fun, as you can hear from our interview today. It's lots of stories and that kind of thing. So I just encourage you to go and grab that book and enjoy it. Enjoy. Well, thanks, Deborah, for being here.
Oh, thank you so much, Marnie. It was my pleasure.
And thank you all for being here, and we'll see you again next time. Bye-bye.